Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you'll hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anybody should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Emma. And I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's workshop is in partnership with the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation. And you'll be hearing more about them and what they do during the program. Today's program is supported by Bristol Myers Squibb, and I would like to thank them for their support of this program. I just would like to acknowledge that we have over 150 participants on the program today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Maluvi, Mauritius, Nepal, United Kingdom, and Vietnam. So it's a global call as well, and we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. To spend this next hour with us. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Richard Grawa. And Dr. Grawa is Professor of Medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Jacoby Medical Center. And Dr. Grawa will be addressing an overview of mesothelioma in the context of COVID, Omicron, seasonal flu, and allergies. And then innovative multimodality treatment options, including chemotherapy, surgery, immunotherapy, targeted treatments, and radiation. And he'll say also something about communication with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Grawa.
Hello, and thank you, Carolyn. I am Dr. Richard Grawa, and I'm a thoracic medical oncologist at Albert Einstein Cancer Center in New York. I have the pleasure of introducing this program, which will discuss many aspects of mesothelioma. In that we still have issues of COVID-19 as this program is being presented in May 2023, I'll also make some comments emphasizing caution during this time when COVID-19 or coronavirus infection deserves our attention. We're fortunate to have a most knowledgeable and helpful panel on the call today. I'm particularly pleased to participate with several old friends. We have a very full program. My colleagues will cover the most common modes of treatment of mesothelioma, with Dr. Robert Taylor Ripley addressing surgery. Dr. Hedy Kindler will discuss systemic approaches, including chemotherapy and immune oncology, and we'll have some discussion regarding radiotherapy as well. We are also very pleased to have Ms. Julie Powers on the program, and she'll update us about the programs of the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation. And finally, Dr. Carolyn Mesner will inform us about the many services of cancer care. I'm really looking forward to their presentation. So let's get started. What is mesothelioma? Malignant mesothelioma is a cancer of the covering or lining of several different organs, most often the pleura, which covers the lung and the inside of the chest cavity, or of the peritoneum, which is the lining of the abdomen, or of the covering of the heart, the pericardium. And there are even some rarer forms as well. But about 90% of mesothelioma is pleural, especially in the U.S. and Europe. So we'll concentrate on pleural mesothelioma, but most of the discussion will be relevant to peritoneal mesothelioma and some other mesotheliomas as well. While it is a cancer of the pleura, or covering of the lung and lining tissue of the lung cavity, it is not, mesothelioma is not lung cancer. Why not? Lung cancer is also called formally bronchogenic carcinoma, which means it starts within the lung or bronchial tubes, rather than mesothelioma, which starts in the pleura, the covering, not inside the lung itself. And mesothelioma looks different pathologically, and its cells can function differently than cancer cells. And so under the microscope or with special laboratory studies often done to establish the type of mesothelioma, the type of cancer, we find differences with mesothelioma. Nonetheless, mesothelioma of any of these areas can be difficult to diagnose. As I mentioned, experienced pathologists do special studies on biopsy tissues that are very helpful in telling typical mesothelioma from lung cancer, often adenocarcinoma, or other malignancies from mesothelioma. Now, I think this is a reasonable time to bring up in my presentation briefly the fact that we're discussing mesothelioma while COVID infections remain a strong consideration. The setting is not exactly the same as 1, 2, and especially 3 years ago, but the considerations are important and should not escape our caution. The good news is that most of us have some degree of immunity against COVID now, which was not true at all 3 years ago and was only emerging 2 years ago. Our immunity stems from having gotten the excellent vaccinations that started to become available a little over 2 years ago, and importantly have been improved by keeping up with the boosters. Also, having had COVID can confer some degree of immunity. But as you are likely aware, variations in the COVID virus have evolved over this short time period. Several forms of the COVID virus leading to infection are found in different countries, states, provinces, and communities. Strains of the Omicron variant are quite common these days, as well as earlier COVID virus types. And to address this, the booster shots available for the last several months are multivalent, meaning that they address more than one type of COVID virus. There is constant surveillance of which viruses are more prevalent and where, and later vaccine boosters in the future will address the presence of which COVID is in your area. So why are we taking time on a program about mesothelioma to address COVID? Well, everyone is aware that certain populations of people are at greater risk of severe outcomes when they have COVID. And we still see major hospitalizations and even deaths from COVID. Among the groups, but by no means all-inclusive at greater risk, are people over age 60 or 65, people with malignancies, and people with lung or respiratory conditions. And clearly, individuals with mesothelioma often have two or three of these cardinal risk factors. To fully protect our friends and family members with mesothelioma, it is crucial that caregivers and those in contact with these patients be fully vaccinated and are careful, including masking around such individuals in appropriate settings. And indeed, this brings up why flu vaccines are important for us as prevention, because the same groups are at greatest risk. All of us should have home test kits at home and should be aware at the first sign for these high-risk groups, please notify your doctor at the first sign, and such additional treatments as Paxlovid pills at home may be indicated. Related is the way that all oncology units have gone to remarkable lengths to enhance safety for your visits. So communicate closely regarding visits, and your team has your best interests in mind. Televisits came to prominence during the height of the pandemic to minimize exposure, and these have been appreciated by many individuals with cancer and their families for some of their visits. Televisits can have certain restrictions, so it would be good to discuss with your treatment team if televisits are a good option for you or not. Additionally, please consider accessing cancer care programs dealing specifically with COVID and cancer, which are quite available online in the cancer care archives. And I believe that there will be a new cancer care program on cancer and COVID coming up in about 3 weeks. Now back to more specifically to mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is much less common than lung cancer, about 2% as often, or 2,000 to 3,000 cases per year in the U.S., but on the rise in many places. Men are about four times more likely to have mesothelioma than women, and it is somewhat age-related, much more common in people in their 60s than in people in their 30s or 40s, with the average age of diagnosis in people in their upper 60s or lower 70s. There are two surfaces to the pleura that you may hear the terms about: visceral pleura, or the covering of the lung itself, or parietal pleura that lines the inside of the chest cavity. The pleura is very pain sensitive. After all, we've all heard of pleurisy. So presenting symptoms of mesothelioma often include pain in 70 to 90% of people. And because damage to the pleura can make it more difficult for the lung to function normally, shortness of breath is often seen. The shortness of breath can also be caused by effusions, that is, fluid development in the chest cavity, and with adhesions or scarring, all limiting the ability of the lung to expand fully, or fluid in the peritoneal cavity, which is common, especially in peritoneal mesothelioma, can lead to direct distress in the abdomen. Fatigue is seen in many people with mesothelioma. It may also be related to pain and shortness of breath. And less common is cough, but we can also see decreased appetite for many patients. Now, symptoms differ among individuals. I can't overemphasize the importance of communicating clearly with your nurse and doctor about what's bothering you. This will be reinforced by Dr. Kindler and others. This surely applies when we're discussing mesothelioma, but also for all cancers. Get your questions answered. It's not a complaint or imposition. It's what we as healthcare professionals see as part of what we should be doing. The diagnosis of pleural mesothelioma is generally suspected after an X-ray or CAT scan, and more often the condition of lung cancer is first suspected. Pleural fluid may be taken, but it's tough to make that diagnosis on just the fluid, so an actual biopsy may be important. And again, as I mentioned, pathologists have special studies, especially immunohistochemistry, which can aid in the microscopic examination. There are three main types of malignant mesothelioma. Two of these are called epithelioid and biphasic mesothelioma, and Dr. Kindler will enlarge on these aspects and their influence on treatment. Asbestos is the most common cause. Asbestos fibers can penetrate deeply into the lung and can cause chronic inflammation, which can then extend to the pleura. Asbestos fibers have also been shown to alter the function of protective cells, and then the fibers can create conditions making it easier to develop mesothelioma. And also, these asbestos fibers may have other properties that suppress the immune reaction, making it harder for the body to fight these. You may be aware that there are other asbestos-related diseases such as asbestosis and lung cancer. Remember, mesothelioma is similar to but distinct from lung cancer. So these are some facts concerning the location of mesothelioma, its cause, its symptoms, and diagnosis. The next speakers will address several key topics in treating mesothelioma. I think you'll find the newer treatment approaches to be very interesting and helpful. And we'll have a question and answer period following all the presentations. I'll now turn the program back to Dr. Messner. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gala. That was an outstanding, really, overview of the program today and really lots of information for people to understand and to really help them to understand the next speakers that we have. So thank you so much. And we'll have time at the end for questions as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Robert Taylor Ripley, and Dr. Ripley is the Director of Mesothelioma Treatment Center, Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center, Associate Professor of Surgery, Division of General Thoracic Surgery, Baylor College of Medicine, member of Baylor College of Medicine, Dan L. Duncan Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Ripley will be addressing the role of surgery in the treatment of mesothelioma, clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, and quality of life and lifestyle concerns. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ripley.
Thank you, Ms. Messner. My name is Taylor Ripley, and I'm a thoracic surgeon at Baylor College of Medicine who focuses on mesothelioma. So the first question that I've been asked to address is the role of surgery in the treatment of mesothelioma. Certain patients who present with this disease have it limited to the lining of one side of the chest, in which we can go in and physically remove that lining so that all the disease that we can at least see and feel is out of the body. Prior to considering a patient for evaluation for treatment with surgery, we perform an extensive evaluation. Although a lot of testing goes into the evaluation, it is essentially broken down into testing that determines the stage and the type of tumor, and then testing that determines how strong you are, which is mainly how strong are your heart and lungs. In terms of staging a patient to see where is this tumor, is it located in the lining? Has it spread in the middle of the chest? Is it elsewhere? We obtained studies, one of them called a computed tomography scan, CT scan, or generally called a CAT scan, And then another one where we also obtain a CAT scan, but it's called a PET scan, as the patients receive an IV with sugar in it, which goes to any cells that are rapidly dividing. And then we can see, hey, those cells are rapidly dividing. Do we think that that's mesothelioma that spread to other parts? So we obtain those scans at first. Next, when patients have disease, mesothelioma in the chest, it can spread to areas of the middle of your chest called lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are like pool filters. When you breathe in, there's a certain amount of junk in the air. We get some of it in our blood. It goes to those filters, and it cleans. It happens every day, all day long. We don't notice. But those same filters can pick up tumor cells that break free of the tumor and spread. And so we take biopsies of those areas to make sure the tumor hasn't spread from the chest into the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest. Also, we often take biopsies in the abdomen because we know while we get scans that shows disease might be in the chest, if we look closer, sometimes lower levels of disease is elsewhere, which is important to test and rule out before we undertake surgical removal of the disease. And then lastly, we evaluate how strong a patient is. As I mentioned earlier, it's mostly how strong are your heart and lungs. Most of these tests do not require invasive procedures, but ultrasounds of your heart to see how much blood it ejects every time it squeezes, breathing tests to see how much air the patient's able to breathe out in the first second when they breathe, as well as how much oxygen from the air transmits from the air to their lung. These tests are important so that we can give you an idea of how risky surgery is and how strong you are to handle the surgery. And so for patients who have the appropriate stage and for the patients who are strong enough to undergo surgery, they often undergo removal. And what we should note is almost all patients who have surgical therapy, they have that in addition to other treatment, mostly chemotherapy. So patients who have surgically resectable disease will receive surgery and chemotherapy, at least historically. When we remove the disease, there's two main types of operations that can get it out of the entire body. One is a lung-sparing approach, in which we only remove the lining and leave the lung in place. And the other one is a lung-removing approach, in which the lining, as well as the lung itself, are removed. This is called an extended pleurectomy and decortication versus an extrapleural pneumonectomy. Over the past decade, more and more groups and surgeons who perform this procedure favor the lung-sparing approach in which we remove the lining. That approach is slightly harder on us as surgeons to do. However, it's usually slightly easier on patients to recover from it and do not have the same risk. Therefore, even though these operations have never been directly compared, most of the patients we try to take the lining while leaving the lung. Importantly, Dr. Kindler is going to discuss systemic therapy or treatments that treat the whole body with a medicine, but it is important to talk about systemic therapy in the context of surgery. As I mentioned earlier, patients who have surgery always have a recommendation for chemo, whether we give it before surgery or not, or after surgery. It can go either way, but we almost never recommend patients get surgery alone without some sort of therapy. Historically, that was chemotherapy, and in most cases, it still is. However, we have recently completed a clinical trial where we gave immunotherapy, or what are called immune checkpoint inhibitors that try to turn on your immune system. They literally block the break of your immune system prior to surgery, and then we operated. In our group of 20 patients, the patients did very well. The patients in surgery were feasible, and we saw good results. So now we're about to open another trial where we look at immune checkpoint inhibitors with and without chemotherapy before surgery. So patients receive drugs and then in three cycles and then undergo treatment with removal of the lung. We believe, based on the newer data of patients doing well with immunotherapy, if we can combine that with surgery, we hope that the patients do much better in the long term in helping beat this disease. So lastly, patient's quality of life after surgery is quite important. First of all, mesothelioma itself is detrimental to people's lifestyles. As anybody who has this disease or lives with a person who takes care of a person with the disease, the most common symptoms that it can cause are shortness of breath or difficulty breathing and chest pain. And those symptoms are manageable with a variety of techniques, some of which are medical and some are surgical. Shortness of breath can be caused from the tumor pushing the lung down, or more commonly from fluid filling up, which is removed at the time of surgery. And afterwards, the lung expands and sticks to the chest wall so it doesn't fall down and get pushed over by lung, making it harder to breathe. That is one advantage of doing the type of operation where we use the lung sparing approach and leave the lung in place. Additionally, we know that the quality of life for patients who undergo the lung sparing approach is higher based on data where patients fill out surgery phase and say that their life is easier to manage after this procedure compared to lung removing approach. And we also know that the quality of life of patients who are older, which we specifically evaluated patients over 65 years old, is also better with the lung sparing approach. So while our goal in surgery is to remove all the disease in hopes that it doesn't come back, our other goal with surgery, and with remove it all or other techniques, is to remove the fluid so that patients can breathe better based on their lung being able to expand better. So all in all, surgery has a benefit in combination with chemotherapy that may help patients live longer, and also it has potential benefit in helping patients breathe better. Current trials to improve the role of this, other than different drugs that go with surgery, include radiation. Currently, patients may receive chemotherapy and surgery and then receive radiation to the chest wall. Historically, the lung had to be removed, or the old types of radiation caused so much damage that the patient's breathing was actually worse. Now there's more advanced techniques where the radiation can be delivered in a mapped out way to the chest wall without significant damage to the underlying lung. That was shown to be safe and effective in a publication in 2016. And currently, we're evaluating this by treating patients with surgery, chemotherapy, and then randomizing, or essentially flipping a coin to see if patients should or should not receive radiation, to see if not only is it safe and effective, but does it also prevent the tumors from coming back, which is the ultimate goal of that approach. And that is another trial that is ongoing on many institutions in this country. So I think my time has come to an end at this point, so I'll turn it over to Ms. Mesner and Dr. Kindler, who are going to talk further about immunotherapy and other systemic therapies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ripley. That was an outstanding presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and you really covered both the surgical approaches and as well as just quality of life issues, which is so important for our participants as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Hetty Lee Kindler. Ms. Kindler is Professor of Medicine, Director of Mesothelioma Program, University of Chicago Medicine. And Dr. Kindler will be addressing the role of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, targeted treatments, and radiation, managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, and some guidelines for communicating with your healthcare team. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kindler.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to speak to all of you today. As Carolyn said, I'm Hetty Kindler. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, where I lead our multidisciplinary mesothelioma program. And I'm going to talk to you about systemic therapy for mesothelioma, as well as radiation. So what is systemic therapy? These are drugs that go through your entire body to attack the cancer wherever it may be. So unlike surgery, which can only treat disease if it's localized, systemic therapy can treat cancer even if it has spread. When we talk about systemic therapy, we're either talking about chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or targeted therapies. So chemotherapy are drugs that can attack cancer cells, which tend to grow faster than normal cells, and therefore can also have side effects on normal cells. The most commonly used chemotherapies are pemetrexed, also known as Alimta, and either cisplatin or carboplatin. These are generally given once every 3 weeks, and often one adds the targeted therapy drug, bevacizumab, also known as Avastin. That one targets something called VEGF, which targets the blood vessels that feed the tumors. Up until very recently, only chemotherapy was standard of care for this disease. The major side effects of chemotherapy include lowering the white cells that help the body to fight infection, the red cells that carry energy and oxygen, and often blood transfusions can be required after one has received often the fifth or the sixth dose of the drug, and affecting the platelets that help this blood to clot. Chemotherapy can cause a skin rash, and there are medications that are used to prevent that. And, of course, for many patients, there's the concern about nausea and vomiting, but there are many medications that can be used to treat the nausea and vomiting and to prevent that. Chemotherapy can also cause fatigue. And it is essential that you let your doctors know what side effects you're experiencing because there are many treatments that can be used to prevent these side effects. Now, up until recently, this was really the only treatment available for patients with mesothelioma. But in 2020, the FDA approved immunotherapy as one of the standard treatments for mesothelioma. Immunotherapy uses your own body's immune system to try to attack the tumor, as Dr. Ripley said, to take the brakes off of your immune system so that it can attack your cancer. The standard drugs are called ipilimumab and nivolumab, or Yervoy and Opdivo. These are generally given every 3 weeks, though they can also be given every 2 weeks. Now, while these drugs are attacking the tumor, they can also attack your own body. And unlike chemotherapy, where you know on what day you might be having fatigue and on what day you might be having nausea, with immunotherapy, the side effects are a little bit less predictable. And thus, it's really essential that you communicate with your doctor what you are experiencing. So the most common side effects of immune therapy are mild tiredness and itching, but they can really attack any body system they want to, in general only one or two. So if it attacks the thyroid, you might need thyroid medicine and you might be experiencing more tiredness. If it attacks the GI tract, you might be having diarrhea. The lung, it might be causing more shortness of breath. The adrenal glands, you might be having more tiredness, or there might be certain salts in the blood that appear abnormal. Again, these are a little bit less predictable than with chemotherapy, but your doctor is going to be monitoring you very frequently for these side effects, and communication with your doctor about these side effects is essential. So how do you and your doctor choose whether it's chemotherapy or immune therapy that you're going to take first? It's really a combination of what your tumor's characteristics are, what the clinical trial data are, and your overall health. Now, Dr. Gralla mentioned that mesothelioma comes in three major flavors: epithelial, sarcomatoid, and mixed or biphasic. I often call it chocolate, vanilla, and swirl. And so if your tumor is predominantly either swirl or chocolate, that is mixed or sarcomatoid, then in general your doctor is going to offer you immune therapy first, because there the improvement that you get with immune therapy is really quite dramatic. Whereas if you have the vanilla or epithelial meso, then immune therapy and chemotherapy have more equivalent effectiveness. And in that situation, your doctor is also going to be looking at what is your kidney function, what is your overall health, and do you have, for example, any autoimmune diseases or other reasons why immune therapy or chemotherapy might be less optimal for you. And then they will then help you make the decision about whether chemotherapy or immune therapy is best for you. And what happens if either the chemotherapy or the immune therapy doesn't work well enough? Well, then there are other treatment options. First of all, if you got immune therapy first, you might be offered chemotherapy. If you got chemotherapy first and it worked for quite some time, you might be offered that chemotherapy again, or you might be offered immune therapy. And then there are other chemotherapy drugs that can be offered, among them gemcitabine or Gemzar, with or without a drug called Cyramza or Ramucirumab, or there's a drug called Vinorelbine, otherwise known as Navalbine. And then there are clinical trials. And clinical trials are important because that's how we learn what the next treatments are, and they can also offer you the option of receiving something you might not otherwise have received. And one of the exciting things in clinical trials right now that Dr. Ripley alluded to is combining chemotherapy with immune therapy. And at least in certain subsets of patients, that does appear to be potentially more promising than offering chemotherapy or immune therapy alone. We know from recent press releases that there was a trial that combined chemotherapy and immune therapy, and that seemed to be better than chemotherapy by itself, but we're still awaiting that final data before we can declare that that is a standard of care, and that is still in clinical trials in other settings. What about radiation? So radiation is a beam that you aim at a particular spot to focus on treating that particular area. Dr. Ripley talked to you about how we use radiation in the post-operative or after surgery setting, but we can also use it in the palliative or symptom management setting. And so if you have an area of the tumor that is, for example, growing into the chest wall, growing into the bone, is causing symptoms in a very focused spot, then radiation can really help alleviate those symptoms. And so I think I've covered all of the systemic therapy aspects. I think a key area of communicating with your physician is simply make sure you have a prepared list of questions if you have them, because sometimes they can just fly out during the moment. You're not going to remember it until after you've gotten home. And make sure that you're always communicating with your physician, with your physician's nurse, about what your concerns are, what these symptoms are. I tell my patients there's no such thing as a dumb question, only a dumb answer. You're experiencing this disease and its side effects, and it's important that you feel that you can always let your physician know what it is that you're experiencing. And with that, I'll hand the mic over and back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kinlow. That was a wonderful presentation and lots of information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Thanks so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Julie Powers, and Ms. Powers is Executive Director of the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, and she also is a partner organization on today's program and on all of our mesothelioma programs that we do. And Ms. Powers will be addressing Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation's free programs and services, and we'll go over the helpline and website with all of you as well. And I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Powers.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. It is my pleasure to be here today. On behalf of the entire team board and our science advisory board of the foundation, I want to say thank you for everyone for being here with us today. The Mesothelioma Foundation is at the confluence of patient and family and caregiver support, as well as investing in critical research to advance our understanding of this incredibly rare disease. As you've heard from our previous, from the rock stars of the mesothelioma world, from Dr. Kindler and Dr. Ripley, their approach to the treatment of this disease, this is very complicated, and it all depends on the type that you have. What we know to be true is that our patients, their family members, and loved ones do better if they have someone to be there to support them at all stages from diagnosis to treatment. What the foundation offers through our website at curemeso.org is that support. We have travel grants to help families and patients get to a qualified mesothelioma expert. We have a nurse on our staff. She's an oncology nurse. She's our patient services director who can help folks get in to see a mesothelioma expert based on those social determinants of health, those aspects of one's life that are important, who's an expert in what area of mesothelioma. And then also we provide ongoing support services at all stages, from our patient support groups to our episodes of Mesothelioma TV or Meso TV, which you can access on our website. For folks who want to learn more or get involved with the foundation, you simply need to head to our website at curemeso.org. We also maintain a toll-free number that can be accessed at 877-363-6376. We are here to help folks at all stages. We also go beyond the immediate treatment of patients during their treatment phase. We are also here to support patients and their families for survivorship. And then, of course, we also provide ongoing support for the members of our bereaved community. So I'd like to turn it back to my colleague and thank everyone for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Powers. That was excellent and a wonderful resource for everybody on this call today. So if you haven't taken advantage of it, please do. It's a wonderful resource. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services, and then we'll move on to the Q&A. But I just want to say a few words. Cancer care is a national organization providing free programs and services to people living with all types of cancer, and mesothelioma, of course, is one of them. And you might want to ask, what does our support look like? How do you contact cancer care? So many people call our helpline, 1-800-813-4673, and speak with an oncology social worker. They're the ones who answer the phone. And there is no wait time when you're actually calling. They're all in queue waiting to get the calls from you. And usually a person starts off with a question that they have, and then the social worker addresses that and then lets them know about all the different services we offer. So what do we offer? We do offer support. We do offer online support groups. We offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance that helps with the costs of care, of course. We also have a resource navigation team who help you if we don't have the resource, let's say it's about food insecurity. That staff will not just give you a list of places to call, but they will go with you to the place that has the resources virtually and get you connected to be sure you get that help. Either it's going to be in your community, regionally, nationally, or all of those above, you know, all of that above, so you can get the care that you need. We also offer these workshops, about probably 80 of them per year, and we also have a number of publications. And we have many other services, and you can access them by going to our website, www.cancercare.org. And so now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Emma to explain to you how to queue up the questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Emma?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So the question, this will be our first question, and I'm going to give this question to Dr. Kindler. My husband was diagnosed with pleural mesothelioma 4.5 years ago.
and is on his last chemo regimen before trial, if we can find one that will accept him due to treatment-induced side effects. Any hope for us now? So if you could address this, Dr. Kimmel, in a general way, in terms of it might be helpful to other participants on the call as well.
Absolutely. So that is always a challenging question. And when patients have another medical issue, whether it is related to whether it is related just to an unrelated medical issue or whether it's related to active side effects from a prior treatment, that can often, unfortunately, exclude them from a clinical trial. If, for example, your kidneys aren't working well enough to allow drugs to be cleared out of your body, then that can be problematic for entry into a clinical trial. But different different trials have different requirements, and so some trials might not allow you on if you're experiencing a particular side effect, but other trials will. So I do think that a wide search can certainly be appropriate. This could be a situation where, for example, reaching out to Julie and her team from the Mesothelioma Foundation can help you identify potential sites for potential trial. If the side effect, however, is that you're spending almost all of your day in bed, not able to function, then you might not be able to handle any trials. But if it is a very specific side effect that you've experienced, it might only exclude you from, for example, if you're having an immune-related side effect, you might not be able to go on an immune-related trial, but you might be able to go on a non-immune-related trial. So A, have a frank discussion with your doctor about what those side effects are, and then B, reach out to an organization such as the Meso Foundation, who might be able to help direct you to trials, as well as seeking out a mesothelioma expert who might, again, be able to help you figure that out.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kinlow. That was excellent and just hopefully very helpful to our participant. Thank you. And our next question for Dr. Ripley, does surgery for sarcomatoid just buy time or remove the disease? What's the recovery like for surgery? What if doctors don't agree on surgery? If you could comment on this in a general way.
Okay, so the first question is surgery for sarcomatoid disease appropriate, is what I got the question is, and what is the timing? The timing of surgery to remove sarcomatoid disease is not different than epithelial disease. If a patient's a surgical candidate, the timing is based on whether or not they received chemotherapy before or after it. These days, given the response of CheckMate 743, which was the trial that compared immune checkpoint inhibitors with nivolumab and ipilimumab to chemotherapy, showed an advantage for the immunotherapy over chemotherapy. But that advantage was the strongest for the sarcomatoid histology. In fact, the improvements in the patient's outcomes with immune checkpoint inhibitors with the sarcomatoid disease was one of the greatest improvements we've seen on any trial to date. And so in the context of whether or not surgery should be done for sarcomatoid, I do think immune checkpoint inhibitors are the first line. Now, does that mean for some patients after getting that therapy and the disease has shrunk, should we remove it? Well, it's a good question, and it's currently an open question in which, given the patients did so well with immune checkpoint inhibitor, would surgery add to that? Currently, we don't know.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr. Ripley. I hope that's been helpful to our participants. And the next question, for Dr. Gralla, if someone has asthma, are they at higher risk of developing mesothelioma? And in that same regard, what if someone had a severe case of COVID that they are still facing repercussions from? Are they at higher risk?
Okay, so I think I understand the question. So the question was, if someone has asthma, Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
If someone has asthma, that is not necessarily related to mesothelioma. Again, it's asbestos. And if one has been exposed to asbestos even decades ago, that increases the risk. Now, other asbestos-related diseases, such as asbestosis and other damages to the lungs, can present a shortness of breath, and perhaps that could be thought of by some people as asthma, but in itself, it truly is not. So if someone has chronic shortness of breath, has had asbestos exposure, then a pulmonary physician could tell the difference, whether that's asthma, which is really a different condition, or whether there's other damage to the lungs, which has been produced by asbestos. But for the overwhelming majority of asthma, that does not, is not related so much to mesothelioma. Now, if one gets COVID, does that predispose an individual to developing mesothelioma? And the answer is no. But if one has mesothelioma, and we're talking indeed about the majority of mesothelioma is pleural, in other words, in the chest, if somebody has mesothelioma and gets COVID, that puts them at greater risk because a lot of times COVID limits your lung ability and even the other effects of COVID for people who already have mesothelioma is a problem. But among the various issues with COVID, developing mesothelioma thereafter is not one of them. Okay, so again, COVID is dangerous in folks with mesothelioma and in many others, but it is not that COVID will give you mesothelioma.
So thank you. And a question for Dr. Kindler. I have mesothelioma, but I've never been around asbestos to my knowledge. That said, are there any genetic predispositions to mesothelioma that could have caused my diagnosis?
That's a great question. So our data and data from others show that about 12% of mesothelioma patients and about 25% of patients with peritoneal or abdominal mesothelioma will have a genetic predisposition. This is thought of as what we call a gene-environment interaction. So to use another example, I have very fair skin, and my genes will make me more susceptible to getting sunburn when I go out into the sun. In the same way, some people's genes may make them more susceptible to low levels of asbestos potentially causing mesothelioma. In addition, asbestos exposure can occur anywhere from 20 to 50 or 60 years ago, and not everybody remembers what they were doing 50 or 60 years ago that could have predisposed them. So yes, indeed, certain genes such as BAP1 and others can predispose patients to develop mesothelioma. The other second most common cause is radiation. If you had radiation for Hodgkin disease or breast cancer or other things, that can also increase your risk of mesothelioma. So it is recommended that patients undergo genetic testing in that setting.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. Excellent, Dr. Kindler. And for Dr. Ripley, for patients with metastatic mesothelioma, peritoneal spreading to pleura or pleural spreading to peritoneum, do you see thoracic surgery as a treatment option to be considered by the patient when systemic options are exhausted? Or would you favor clinical trials or systemic or targeted treatments over surgery? If you could answer this in a general way, Dr. Ripley.
Yes, and each patient's different. And so knowing whether a surgical option is available for patients with disease in the chest and abdomen is requires seeing each patient and making a thorough evaluation. What I do know, recently we published a paper on patients who underwent surgery in the chest and abdomen. Among all the patients we saw at our center, only 3% underwent this approach. And in the, with those patients, we removed the disease from the chest and we removed the disease from the abdomen. And patients did surprisingly well. And so there are some rare cases where surgery is an option. In general, most patients who've had disease that have grown once they've received chemotherapy or immunotherapy or surgery and chemotherapy with a combination of approaches, surgery is not an option to remove all the disease. Sometimes we do it to help patients breathe or help with pain control, but whether or not we should incorporate surgery into cavities is possible in the patients occasionally, but requires a very individual and patient-by-patient evaluation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And then there's a question about, do we have online support groups for teens? So I'm first going to ask Julie Powers if she'd like to comment. If Ms. Powers would like to comment on that, do you have support groups for teens?
We do not currently have support groups for teens. Mesothelioma has not been diagnosed in teens or young adults. So that's not something that we've focused on. However, we do have a caregivers group, and we would be happy to welcome young adults into that group if they'd like to join us. And you can find more on our website. I would also say that your local cancer center, wherever the patient is being treated, they might be able to offer something more age appropriate.
And also, I should add to that Cancer Care also offers online support groups, mainly for caregivers, either teens or young adults who are caregivers for someone. So those, and again, you can just go to our website. And I should tell you all that we're going to be providing, at the end of this program, you'll be getting, well, in a couple of days, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation. That's an evaluation of the program itself. But in addition to that, we will be providing all the resources that we mentioned today. So you'll be having the resources for the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, as well as for Cancer Care, any other resources that we think would be of help to you. And I actually am going to ask each of our speakers to provide, and I also should mention that we do have a COVID program taking place on May 22nd. Some of you may have signed up for that, but it's really an update on COVID. And so for those of you who haven't signed up for it, you might like to, and you'll be getting information about that as well. And now I'd like each of our speakers just to provide takeaways from today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Gualas and Dr. Ripley, then Dr. Kindler, then Ms. Powers. So we'll go in that order. So just a quick takeaway for our participants.
So this is Richard Gralla. So my quick takeaway would be you have a cancer care team. You have an oncology team for yourself. We've spoken about general issues today that we hope will help educate you to ask the good questions that Dr. Kindler has said. And I would say, yes, go ahead and communicate as you can any issues or questions with your care team. And that can make it more specific for your own mesothelioma care, and they can help you in terms of eligibility for clinical trials, availability of clinical trials, and symptom control, and how you should go about preventing side effects of treatment. And that would be my message. Let's make sure we communicate well with our oncology teams that are there for you and your family specifically.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hall and Dr. Ripley.
My take-home point from this conference is with a new diagnosis of mesothelioma, it's important to have a very thorough evaluation. Many patients are in communities where they may be the only person or one of a few people who've had this diagnosis, so reaching out in order to find support groups through the Meso Foundation or through one of our clinics can help you navigate this process so you do not feel like you're alone.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Kindler.
Yeah, I would emphasize that this is a disease that really requires individualized treatment, that many local oncologists are not as familiar with this disease. And so if you have the opportunity to have an expert involved in your care that can be helpful. We have made remarkable progress in the treatment of this disease in just the last few years. And so certainly an individualized approach is essential. And there are many clinical trials available to patients. It's the only way we're going to be able to advance this field even further and enable you to get cutting-edge treatments that you might not otherwise be able to access.
Excellent. And Ms. Powers, yes.
I think the thing that I'd like to just make sure that everyone knows is you're not alone. While there are so many people, it's a rare disease, but there are so many people in our community, in the meso community, who are here to support patients, families, and caregivers at every step of the way. And we're here to help, and that's what we do. And just, you know, drop us a line, give us a call, and we're here to connect you with support groups to help you find a clinical trial, if that's appropriate, to help you get a second opinion with a mesothelioma expert. But we're here, and you are not alone.
Excellent. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I want to thank all of our participants as well for the really great questions they asked. Although we've done this program before, I have to say the questions today were really quite thoughtful and excellent questions. And our speakers, of course, were outstanding. And I just want to reiterate what Ms. Powers has said, that we don't want anyone to leave this program feeling that you're alone. We want you to now know that you're part of a community support. It starts with your healthcare team, but you also have the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation as a resource, Cancer Care. And we'll be giving you lots of other resources as well, but certainly the Meso Foundation is certainly the very best place to start with because that is what they specialize in. They're unique in that respect, and that's a wonderful resource. And, of course, your healthcare team. And please do ask your healthcare team questions that you have. So those of you who asked questions today or had a question yet to ask or in queue to ask a question, please take your question back to your healthcare team, and it will probably, what you've learned today will inform your question, and you'll feel stronger in asking your question. So please do that. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. We look forward to being on other calls, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.